Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is CEO of Sequoia Studios in Spain, Brendan Fitzgerald. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Stuart. Thank you for having me.
Right then, we're going to talk about the company you work for, Sequoia Studios, and we're going to talk about three films that have impacted everything in your adult life, which should be fun, and there are three great films to discuss later. But first, let us focus on your job as CEO of Sequoia. It's a relatively new company, it seems. It was its third anniversary when you joined at the beginning of last year. We're about to hit its fourth anniversary. And I think it was in one of your speeches or in the when you took the job, you were saying that Sequoia will be recognized as one of the most talent-friendly studios in Spain. What does that mean in terms of, I mean, what are the things that make a studio talent friendly?
Well, that's really one of our top goals right now. We are not today the talent friendly studio in Spain. I think talent friendly for us in 2024-25 is creating a home where artists and creatives feel free to bring their best ideas and their best stories. Mm-hmm. We recognize their needs from a production input side. We have the hardware that we have here at Sequoia, I think, is unparalleled. Mm-hmm. From a financial development fund side, from an access to platforms side. I think we're in a great position when we have the best creatives in Europe coming to us with their best ideas first.
So, as a company, then, just in, as a general overview, then, what in your role are you overseeing? What sort of work and output we like to see from Sequoia?
Sequoia Studios is the content generation and monetization group within a larger entity called Sequoia Content Group. Mm-hmm. So my group, we handle all of the, you know, the intake of a pitch through its development, its production, and its distribution. And we're very, very active across pretty much all aspects of the market. This year, we will deliver, I think, 4 to 5 feature films, 4 to 5 premium series, so 8 to 10 episodes. We will deliver a daily drama of 60 episodes. We will deliver 2 daily magazines for one of the channels here in Spain. We have a very active unscripted group that will do, I think, 4 documentaries this year, a number of true crime, and some reality formats, one of which was just nominated for La Rose d'Or last week. So we're incredibly active. We are calling on clients, I would say, an average of twice a week, if not 3 times a week. That's 150 client meetings a year to pitch and to sell and to learn.
Wow.
And that's just within Spain.
And I was interested to read that you were saying that you wanted to be language agnostic as a key strategy, aiming for more English language projects seems to be a priority.
Yeah, I think historically we were Spanish language oriented, and that did 2 things. It limited us to production in Spain to a great deal, and it led us to, I think, a false pursuit of selling Castilian shows in Latin America.
Uh-huh.
And to a lesser extent, assuming that if we made something in Spanish anywhere in the world, we could sell it to anybody who spoke Spanish. And now we're moving into a situation where I would like to, let's say by 2028, have half of our revenues come from outside of Spain.
Your colleague, James Costas, said that sort of Spain has become a gold mine for developing global productions. You've been in Spain a while. What is Spain doing so well or differently than other European countries to make it have that much potential?
Well, I think one of the things is that we're opening ourselves up to other voices from other countries and other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, a lot of the shows that are starting in Spain are really designed for Spain and then do extremely well on the SVOD platforms.
Right.
It is not the case that the shows that begin and end on free television in Spain are traveling that far.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the ones that might have a first window on free, a second window here on SVOD, and then travel abroad. I think Spain is really in an extraordinary position right now, and it's ready to have its moment, or its, you know, I'm ready for my close up, Mr. DeMille. I think the U.S. is still struggling a great deal post pandemic and post the negotiation of the three big guild agreements, and they're still struggling through that hangover. And I think that the reticence of the U.S. market to pick up U.K. shows because of their economic situation is having a knock-on effect on U.K. productions having trouble making their numbers. And our doors are open. We have budgets that are driven by common sense on the left-hand side in terms of what we need and for how long. They are driven by market needs on the right-hand side by how much do they cost. One thing that people don't know, that our long-term view to maintaining costs here in Spain is we have a university here on site
mm-hmm.
that has some 3,000 students studying production and learning production skills, whether they're here on site or online. Because, you know, Spain is known for delivering value for money, quality for value. And we have a very robust and highly dependable tax incentive. Our geography, our geology, I think we can deliver anything except enormous amounts of jungle. I really think that we can do any climate, any geography in the world other than enormous amounts of jungle. And the level of English language is no longer just at the department head level. It goes all the way through. And to be honest, what I'm saying now is really not just limited to Sequoia. It's also our competitors.
Yeah.
Spain is an extraordinary place to do business right now. And, you know, we are actively searching for projects. Just 2 weeks ago at Content London, you know, if you have a show that is 20% over budget, 23% over budget, you've got that gap, come here. We will bring down your budget. We will apply our tax incentive. And if it's the right kind of project, Sequoia will step in and take an equity piece. We want to bring global productions to Spain, not just as a production service at all, but as a partner, as a co-producer.
When you talk about that training facility in the university campus that's part of the studio, I mean, is that a unique? I mean, I've never heard of that kind of symbiotic relationship before between learning and the production of TV and film.
It is not common at all, but it's probably the high point of when we bring somebody here to see our campus.
Yeah,
their whole take on Sequoia changes when we walk into the university. It's right here on campus. It is a joint venture with an extraordinary publishing company in Spain called Planeta, who in addition to being a publishing house, runs universities.
Hmm.
And so this is something that we are doing here. It is very active. It is very successful. In addition, I would say half of the executives here at Sequoia teach at the school.
Okay.
Our head of finance and operations is doing a 3 times a week, 13-week course. Others will go over and do a 90-minute masterclass and everything in between. We are actively hiring. We have assistants. We have production coordinators who have graduated and are now part of Sequoia. And it's not just limited to Spain. We are setting up, you know, here we have Madrid Content City. In Bogota, I will give you a chance, Stuart, to guess what the name of that one's going to be. And we are working with Planeta to set up an analogous university there in Bogota Content City to plant these seeds around the world. The U.S. relies on a sort of a trainee system where you go in and you learn how to pull a cable, and then you have that responsibility for 2 shows, and then you graduate to the next level, and you graduate to the next level. And that's a great way of inculcation of all these skills. That sort of real guild system doesn't exist here, and so we created the university to replace it.
But I mean, I taught a couple of years ago at one of the colleges in Britain, and I did one of the big things I worried about doing it is, like, I can talk about writing for TV and stuff, but I can't show you the line to where you get work or where how work comes to you. And that idea of being in and around it happening and maybe opportunities being part of your learning experience seems quite powerful.
There's script writing, of course, but there's also lighting. There's also sound design. It's also so technical skill, and you can develop a concentration and work your way through the school. It's really very special.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, given your experience in TV coming from Sony into this job, was and in particular European TV, was where are we going at the moment with it? And in a sense, something we talked about before we started recording, you mentioned that we're past the peak TV period, and I think that links into what you were saying about the way SVOD has kind of reined itself in and begun. It's almost like SVOD has disrupted the market, and now we're seeing adverts. It's like they're becoming what the market was in the way that we consume content on our TV.
There was a fascinating speech maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago where someone posited, what if nobody had reacted to Netflix? What if they had just gone DVDs and then onto SVOD and nobody had done anything and Netflix just existed and everybody else existed? That may not have been a stupid response. So that's just something to think about. I think we're in a great situation because past peak TV, let's say that we're at 72% of peak TV, but holding steady.
Yeah.
I'd much rather be there than on an ever-expanding slope of demand where people are throwing stupid money at projects just to get them, and then not knowing when's the last day of that. Is it Tuesday? Is it 4 years from now? And now that we're on a steady state, that bubble has not popped, but we're being driven by P&L. I'd much rather be there. I can compete on a more level playing field. I can deliver shows. It's more of a meritocracy in terms of I have a good idea at a fair price, at fair terms, than I have the next Succession. I have the next Game of Thrones. I have the next Marvel show. It's not really ready, but just take it anyway, or somebody else is going to get it. That was no way to run a railroad.
So from the producer point of view, or even from the writer who might be sort of looking at the very start of a process, what do you think, what kind of TV shows do you think the writer of today should be considering to take out into the marketplace? If it is at that 72%, what is the room for in that maybe?
I don't know what kind, but what I'd like to do in my position at a studio like this is to give the writer the comfort that they can take their time to do it right.
Okay.
That it's no longer whoever can hand in their scripts next gets the next show.
Okay.
We're in a competitive situation. If we are not aiming for an A grade, and I don't know if that works in the UK or not.
Yeah, yeah.
If we're not aiming for an A grade in a market that has just contracted, we're out of business. Quality is back to being the absolute name of the game.
Okay.
And I think that it's always been important, and the quality shows have always risen to the top. But I personally, and now I'm not speaking as a person of Sequoia, I'm speaking as a person who owns a remote control, I wouldn't mind if there were fewer shows to have to select from.
When you took the job, I was interested by the quote you said that you believe it is better prepared to adapt to changes in the market and consumer behavior in both the short and medium term. What do you think are the headline changes in terms of market and consumer behavior that need to be adapted to?
I don't think the consumers really require a lot of adaptation. I think the consumers are the least responsible for all of the changes. None of the people who own all these TV sets and all these apartments and houses ever asked for any of this to happen. The enormous increase in quantity and absolutely increase in quality over the last 10 years has been driven by SVODs fueled by bonds issued on Wall Street to capture market share of a business that they created and then wanted to capture, to hold on to.
Yeah.
And I think that now that they are also being held to the same standards, i.e. Wall Street measuring them on their profitability and P&L, which are the standards that I'm being measured here at Sequoia and that a CBS is being measured, we're now on something much more akin to a level playing field. So I think that that's going to be much more interesting. I think that as far as the industry is concerned, that's going to bring back, and it has, co-productions as a way of financing television shows, because now the Netflix of the world, the Amazon of the moment, needs to measure how much do they actually want to pay, can pay, need to pay for the opportunity of providing this viewing experience to their subscriber.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do they actually need to pay 120% of the cost, 110% of the cost, or can they get away with paying 45% of the cost just for what they're actually going to use, just for the utility that they require?
Okay.
And so that gives me the opportunity to hold back rights. So as an example, I can speak to SVOD, call it Netflix here in Spain, and instead of them taking global rights and paying a premium on top of the show, maybe they just focus on what they need. They just take the piece that is of value for them for Spain. I can then go to a free television in Spain and offer them the first free TV window after that SVOD window. And then I have the tax credit here from Spain. I've essentially covered all of my costs, and I've only given away one territory. I've only sold one territory. I have the rest of the world, and I've held on to rights. Whereas, you know, in a buyout situation, I would have more cash. I would have taken on less risk, but I would be looking around at my crew and at my facilities and say, okay, now we got to start from scratch again, because all that work we've just given away for a price.
Is that a change that's actively happened now? Because, you know, the idea was that Netflix always wanted everything. You know, a Shudder was going to take all of your English language rights if they ever took on you. You know, these are the ones that knew. So is that kind of bargaining position changing? So it's becoming less global at a snap and more global if you want it, but you can jigsaw it together if you want.
I mean, Netflix is always trying to optimize their investments. Here in Spain, Amazon regularly windows with other outlets in Spain, mm-hmm. And leaves you to handle international. Netflix in Italy is doing this. Netflix in other territories in Europe is doing this. Are they going to start in, have they started in Spain? Not yet. Might they announce their first one tomorrow? Absolutely possible. But I think that, you know, Netflix itself was in the business of generating subscriptions, subscriber growth. And I think now they have to balance subscriber growth with profitability. And that's going to mean being smarter about their investments, which gives us the chance to be smarter about how we deploy our rights. So.
And I don't know if there's an answer to this or not, but it just struck me that the writer's strike and COVID were almost the perfect storm to halt the disruption that had gone on previously. To answer your question of if we'd not reacted to Netflix, what would the world look like? In a way, the correction seems to have been the tragedy of COVID plus the writer's strike, and then everything contracted and went, whoa, you know, did the reset after that almost. I'm guessing it speeded up a situation that might have took longer to get to, but we were always going to get here.
I agree. I think that the guild agreements in the US may prove to have been, you know, something that is going to take a
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Longer to swallow and digest than was anticipated.
It's interesting what you said there about the consumer at the beginning of that, because I was at Black Knights in Tallinn, and I took part in a think tank, and one of the participants said, and this was looking at like the next generation of viewers, as it were, and it was like in Germany they did a study of 7 to 11 year olds about how they viewed film, and 7 to 11 year olds don't think of a feature film like you and I would when you hear the words feature film. They just think of video being long or short. So a feature film to them, because they've had phones, screens, TV, and possibly cinema, they all meld into one, and it's just video, whether it's 30 seconds on TikTok or 2 hours of Wicked.
Absolutely. That being said, their eyes still light up when you take them to the actual theater, you know, to have that experience.
Thank you for sharing that about Sequoia and your thoughts on TV in Europe. And now we move on swiftly to 3 films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Okay, right then. The rules are simple, Brendan. You've given me 3 films. We're going to talk about each film for 5 minutes. And when the 5 minutes are up, we're going to hear this sound. Right then, first off is a 1994 movie that was one of the first movies to use internet advertising. It opened on the same day as Shawshank Redemption, which I didn't know. Both were nominated for 7 Academy Awards. Both gained cult status in the following years and are listed in the top 10 of the IMDb top 250 movies. It cost only $8 million, $5 million of which went to the actors, and it grossed over $200 million. I'm talking about Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. Where does that fit in your film watching life? Why did that have such an impact on you?
That had an impact on me because it took me about half the movie. I remember I watched it. It was down on 13th Street in New York City on the east side. Uh-huh. And it took me about half the movie to realize that the 4 stories were not being told in order. Mm-hmm. They were broken up across the thing. And it dawned on me that there was if the characters were so well drawn, structure could be thrown to the wind within the rules that the director or the writer or had created. And it just became a fascinating experience just to sit there in the theater and to realize that life is very often like this. You never get, you might hear somebody tell you a story at a table, but the story of your friend's breakup or the story of your doctor's kids' travails, huh? You always get them in chunks and in pieces. And just sitting there and watching this insane set of stories wash over you, it ripped apart all of the imprint of like fairy tales. You get Little Red Riding Hood read to you in bed, and that is that. That is exactly how the story happens. Mm. And you become accustomed to that. And then you watch Lost in Space in black and white and then in color on television. And Will Robinson, and that's how it happens. And then watching this, which was clearly, you know, professionally done, there's not, you know, some slapdash, and having it just having sort of disemboweled, ripped apart, and put back together, and having it make sense, you know, because a new set, a new world was created, and those new rules were absolutely followed. Mm-hmm. It told a severely demented story in a way that was completely palatable and enjoyable. I mean, the violence, the extremes, and everything was almost easier to handle by having it been taken apart and put back together. And demented is a funny word, because years later, when I was working at Columbia TriStar, before it was Sony, they had been offered the show and the film, and they had turned it down. And the comment was the story was too demented. And then it went, and it eventually was made by the Weinstein Company. But I just remember that the idea that you could explode structure and reassemble a story and not only not lose the audience, but take them on a completely new trip. Mm. Just really stuck with me forever.
Tarantino on the commentary track for Reservoir Dogs sort of rails against the comment that what he does is, because traditionally you call it non-linear storytelling. And mm-hmm. Quentin Tarantino rails against this description. He says, this is the order I'm telling you the story. Mm-hmm. As in like what you were saying is like, it's the way to tell the story. Even though it feels obtuse compared to how a fairy tale might be told, but actually Tarantino is saying, I tell it in this order. So that is the story. And I quite like that. I've never heard of that like defense of it before, but it makes, obviously if he's the author, he knows, doesn't he? Yep. And in that demented sense, I was in the research before, for the people that can count these things, there are 265 fucks in this film. And on that foul language bombshell, we shall move on. Right, your second film, Mel Gibson initially turned down the lead role, feeling he was too old for the part. He was 38 at the time, and the character he was playing apparently died when he was 35. But Paramount Pictures wouldn't finance it. I'm guessing he was already lined up to direct it, but I guess they wanted him in it as well.
He only took it when he was able to direct it as well.
Ah, okay, so that's I didn't realize that as well. There were over 1,600 extras in some of the battle scenes. I may be giving this away now. Most of who were members of the Irish Army Reserve. They were from different companies and there was rivalries between them. So apparently in those fight scenes, there was a lot more real fighting going on than usually would be allowed by a stunt coordinator. I'm indeed talking about 1995's Braveheart. So where do you see this? Why does this have an impact on you?
I think this one really falls into very mainstream, very middle of the road. When everything comes together, here is an epic, heroic movie that works. This is ages before all the Marvel superheroes and everything. Hmm. But the person called on their journey the resistance to taking up the fight. It just succeeded in transporting me to that world that you don't realize how few women there are in the movie. The women that are there are absolutely key. His love is in every scene in one way or another. But it just seems like an incredibly balanced movie between men and women, despite the lack of women on the screen, just because his entire trip, it's almost like a love story with the partner missing. It's a long movie. It really held my attention. It was one of those magical moments where you step away and you say, I will never live up to what that man did. but getting to the point in my life where I'm okay with that. I think it was almost the inverse of the Pulp Fiction experience. It was, it's very linear. There's really not much of a B story even. It was one of those moments where you fall in love with what quote unquote Hollywood can do. And you stop trying to, you don't imagine yourself doing the guitar solo at the concert. You don't imagine yourself doing anything, but just you are a gifted, fortunate viewer. It was just a wonderful experience. That was just a purely personal ride. So.
Absolutely. Being an Englishman, I can tell you that many Scots were offended by the portrayal of Robert the Bruce, who's obviously considered to be a national hero, and I don't think the film does him as much justice. Interestingly, I don't know if you noticed this, but the screenwriter is called Randall Wallace, obviously William Wallace being the titular character of Braveheart. And apparently he, and this is completely coincidental to his writing life, he went to Edinburgh as part of his own sort of journey to in 1983 and discovered this figure of William Wallace, who we didn't know about.
I think he adapted the screenplay from an epic poem.
Okay. Well, there's every chance, because he basically, since 83, he'd been researching, just because he had the same surname almost. And that became a job.
Totally apart from Wallace and Gromit.
Of course, yeah. No, I don't think he followed that mythos at all. No. It's also the going back to the demented side of Pulp Fiction, but also there's a cut of Braveheart before it was released that was NC-17, they were saying, if they didn't cut it, because it was, I guess it was just shot well, because if cinematically it feels that violent, it can often just be about the art of cinema. You know, you think of Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Titan recently, these films, you think you're watching violence, and then...
Well, not only do you think you're watching violence, but there are so many productions that fall short of trying to portray heroic death.
Finish your thought.
There's an awful lot of heroic death in Braveheart.
Yeah, but I suppose it follows the pattern of Saving Private Ryan, which is, that has one of the most horrific scenes you'll ever see in your life. Sequences, you'll ever see in your life. Mm-hmm. Right then, and this is quite nice, because you, I didn't, when I got this, like, sequentially, we've gone 94, 95, and for your third film, we're going to jump into 1996. A film that runs for exactly 2 hours, in line with the prologue, which states, is now the 2 hours traffic of our stage, which I never knew till I did a bit of research on this today. Written and directed by Baz Luhrmann, his big step towards a Hollywood career making, after movie making, after his cult hit Strictly Ballroom. And it sounds like Leonardo DiCaprio had such an active role in getting the film over the line. He did spec auditions for investors on straight to video. He made sure Claire Danes was Juliet. That was because he was convinced that she from the auditions they had, she was the only one who he thought could do it. And at that point, he's on the brink of becoming a movie star as well. This is like Titanic is 2 years later, I think, or a year later. So for you, where does this film fit in your I mean, very tonally, very different than the previous two. There's no, certainly no no graphic violence in this one in the same way.
I think this one was an example for me of just how far you could stretch what these days we might even refer to callously as a remake. Mm. And just the world that was created by Luhrmann, the sheer level of the actors, if you look at that cast, mm. even Lady Capulet, who has six lines, Mrs. Montague, Miss Lady Montague, who has, I think, even fewer. Lady Capulet was an extraordinary, her name escapes me right now, but an extraordinary Shakespearean actress who is not, she looks an awful lot like Jessica Lange, but is not. Her name escapes me, but she's really just extraordinary. But the entire world, again, just and the selections when there is rage, when there is conflict, is when Verona Beach is at the fore, and you're taken to sort of a Mexican rundown city, urban grit. And then the moment that we sort of most pedantically associate with Romeo and Juliet are played completely straight. It's face-to-face, it's close-ups, it's beauty shots, it's eye-to-eye. There are no trappings. And so when the two of them meet, it's the purest moment in that crazy party through the aquarium. The two of them, as he says, you know, woo, it's the balcony and the pool, and there's nothing there that couldn't be Shakespearean or couldn't be in the backyard of a house in Pasadena. It's sort of timeless there. And so all of the, wow, look at me, I'm Baz, is gone in all of their honest moments. And then, and just the way that he plays with you, you know, if you go back and watch it again, there are moments that remind you of ballroom. There are moments, there's little tricks that are stolen or repeated in Moulin Rouge. Mm-hmm. But it was just another example to me, kind of like Pulp Fiction, but this story is so good and so well done and so well constructed that we can really mess with it in this, you know, rule-filled way and still maintain the story. For me, it really points to, you know, one of the simplest Shakespearean plays, one of the simplest Shakespearean tragedies, and it just holds its own regardless of what you throw at it. And it just points to the pure beauty of the storytelling and the writing.
I could see the clock getting to zero, so I thought I'll let the silence hang on the end of that one. But in truth, it's you know, the power of a good story means you can push it through any sort of prism, and it'll still be a good story. And the fact that, because I'd only before then I'd seen the Richard III with Ian McKellen, where mm-hmm. they did the World War I, but again kept the original Shakespearean dialogue against the backdrop of something.
I mean, if you go back, you've got this. This is 1996. Then you have Zeffirelli, which I think was 66, with Olivia Hussey. And then before that, there's just George Cukor, 36. And so anybody today is probably not going to go all the way back to watch Olivia Hussey.
I can't say I have.
And I had my son. I took my son, and we sat down for a weekend, and we watched the Zeffirelli, and then we watched Baz Luhrmann, and then we watched Shakespeare in Love.
Okay.
And we did that over like a Saturday and a Sunday, and he was like 15 or 16 at the time. And I wanted to see how that went. And the headline was, is there a version where the messenger gets there on time? Those are my movies.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. And thank you for giving us that insight into Sequoia. You said you had a question for me. What was the question?
You've been doing these podcasts for a while.
Yeah.
Are there any films that tend to crop up when you ask people for their three films? Are there some that tend to keep floating to the top?
Not as many as you'd think, to be honest with you. Yours is the second Braveheart. I've never had Romeo and Juliet yet. I think you might be the second, because I've only been doing this format for 18 months. Prior to that, I did things like Five Great British Horror Films, which in the end did become repetitive because of the nature of it's such a small pool of films. There's only so many times I want to talk about Wicker Man, Blood and Satan's Claw, and Witchfinder General, as good as they are. Whereas this remit, because it's about not... If I think if I'd have said, give me your favourite films, I reckon it would have ended up being a bit repetitive. But because I'm asking for film memories and impact, it sort of opens it up for people to say, actually, that film that I saw that made me want to be an actor or made me want to be a producer, you know, made me change the way I think. So, I mean, if it was me, if the shoe was on the other foot and you were asking me, I've got Smoking the Bandit, Time Bandits, and Cannibal Holocaust would be three films that they're not necessarily my favorite films. But they definitely had impact on why I'm sat here talking to you now.
Yeah. Smokey and the Bandit. I remember that.
Brendan, and you'd be glad to know, I was dreading it when I rewatched it in the noughties on DVD, like thinking it'll have, you know, time will have caught up with it. And, you know, if you watch like Clint Eastwood's Every Which Way But Loose and any Which Way You Can, they don't live in the 21st century. Well, I'm happy to say that Smokey the Bandit very much is comfortable in 21st century. Jackie Gleason saves the day on every front. Well, look, I will let you get on with your day. Thank you very much for giving your time on the Britflix podcast.
Okay, thank you very much.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.